Blog Talk Radio.
Live from the nation's capital, it's Quintessential Listening, Poetry, with host Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram.
Welcome James Steck to the program. James, are you with me?
Hi, Michael. Yeah.
How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, not a problem. I heard you recently at an event here in Washington, D.C., and I said, hey, that guy needs to be on the air. So I'm glad that you agreed to come on the air.
Yeah, of course. It's great. It's been a few months since I ran into you last, but I'm really happy to be talking to you again.
Well, let me ask you a question. What was an early experience where you learned that poetic language had power?
I suppose back in somewhere around fifth grade, when I was about 11 years old. Yeah, and it was about the same time that I started to really kind of experiment with art as expression and self-expression. I've always really been into art, and I think it kind of branched out into writing also, and kind of abstract expression and trying to piece the world together in that way. And I remember in fifth grade, I think I had this little poem published at Loudonville Elementary School. I had this little literary publication, and I was so proud that I used this word catastrophe correctly in like one of the lines of the poem. But I just remember the feeling of feeling kind of free in a way through language pretty early on. So I think that was my earliest memory of kind of how freeing language can be, and poetry specifically, kind of abstract meaning making in a way. If that answers your question.
Yes, you did. That was a perfect answer. But what exactly is poetry?
That's a weird question, but a good one. So for me, I guess, I think of it kind of as a construct of understanding and reflection. And I mean that as kind of, it's almost like an act of molding or bending to the will of what I think is ultimately maybe out of my control in a way. Because I think all the time I look at an image or something that I find compelling or that stands out to me in some kind of bizarre or unique way. And it confuses me, maybe makes me uncomfortable. And so what I try to do maybe is kind of over time bend to the will of that discomfort and try to create constructs in a way around it. I kind of think of Wallace Stevens. I'm kind of obsessed with this one line of his in his poem, The Idea of Order in Key West, where he writes, "Oh, blessed rage for order." And I kind of have that line floating around constantly. Kind of in the back of my head, and I'm trying to piece together and this kind of interesting kind of abstraction comes out of trying to arrange the world or bending to the will of the world in a way. I guess I kind of think of as poetry as a construct of trying to understand the world and meaning making in a way. maybe I got lost in that sentence a little bit.
No, no, no. That,
I
that was great. Because I think it leads into my next question. You happen to be an English teacher.
Yeah.
How do you make the students understand why poetry is important?
Oh, that's a really good question. It's really hard because so often, you know, I'll introduce a unit and say like, oh, we're going to be doing a lot of poetry in this unit. You get a sea of groans across the classroom. And it's difficult to try and connect poetry or make it relevant to the kids. But I've done it frequently. I've connected with the kids through music most often. And looking at the lyricism of music. And I've also learned a lot from kind of patiently being tenacious about really trying to understand what a poem is and what a poem is trying to tell you about the world. Even if it takes 30 or 40 minutes of a class period, kind of going line by line, just trying to understand literally what the words in the poem are meaning, just at the superficial level, before we get into a deeper discussion. And honestly, it's almost like kind of a methodical, cathartic process, I find, with the kids after we kind of get into the nitty-gritty of each line. And I like them having them experiment too. If they can feel like they're playing with language in a kind of safe environment, that they're not going to be judged or put down or questioned about how they're writing a line or playing with language. I think that's also one of a good way to kind of introduce and engage them in poetry.
You know, as you think about your own work, what are some of the predominant themes of your work?
Predominant themes. So I find myself kind of focusing a lot on kind of societal anxieties, or maybe they're just my own anxieties that I'm hoping that people connect to. Or social contradictions, I think sometimes. I focus a lot on the passage of time. Also, the word time itself kind of pops up over and over and over again in a lot of my poems. And I also just try to keep it kind of funny. I think a lot about absurdity and absurdism. And back to that kind of process of meaning making, the kind of weird absurdity we all go through to try and make meaning for ourselves in the world. And so the kind of contradiction between trying to find meaning, perhaps maybe in something meaningless, in a way is inherently funny. And so I think sometimes that comes through. But I'm thinking of a poem that might kind of get that across as an example.
Would you like to share it?
Sure, yeah. Let's find it here. So it's a little bit of context. Actually, today I was just teaching a short story from Tobias Wolff called A Bullet in the Brain. And it references the final three phrases in that story. And so the poem is called Absurd. And the quote beneath the title is, "They is, they is, they is. They is like stars that realize they've already died and peripherally burn. A sacrosanct illusion for astronomers, knowing that looking through telescopes each day is better than the hangover of someone asking for help without the safety of the lens. 1/4 smile and a twitching eye, and then there's the nothing, only the inaudible, I'm sorry, and an awkward smile. And no one really knows what to do after that but keep on walking and walking and wondering Who could I blame more than myself for that? On the rooftops of swollen nights, we watched stars die and peripherally burn through city streets at dusk. Your 16-ounce McDonald's cups, empty like an atom held in a hand. Some ask politely, but we prefer the musicality of fuck you as rain taps its foot along to a cup of quarters. I gave a man my lunch. He looked disappointed. So did I. End poem.
Now, do you sit and think through every word of every stanza, or do you write freely and allow the words to flow?
It's kind of a mix of both. Sometimes I'll kind of obsess over an image or just a feeling for maybe a few days, even a week or more. And then I come down or come and sit down and try to piece it together. And in those instances, I find the word choice to be a little more slow and a little more of a process and a little more careful. But I also do sit down and just kind of vomit onto the page in a way. And then after the fact, I'll kind of look through what has come out and see what this piece of writing is wanting to be. I find it kind of weird as a process. I find poems don't come out the way I want them to, or the way that I hope when I try to kind of implant my own will over it, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does.
It's like a process of chiseling away at what this kind of thing that has come out, you know, wants to be. So it's sort of an interesting and weird feeling.
Well, do you vomit on the page often? How often do you write?
So during the summer, last summer in 2019, I had a lot of time off and I forced myself to write every single day, whether I thought it was decent or a load of crap. I never deleted it. I would just kind of leave it and give it space. But I would try to write every day. And even now, as teaching has started to pick up again, I do find it hard to kind of find time where I am willing to kind of feel vulnerable or in an uncomfortable space consistently. But I do try and still write at least 3 or 4 times a week, at least something, some idea, some thought, some image, just a little note if it's on my phone, or even if I kind of leave it in the back of my head for a bit and kind of let it simmer and react and kind of interact with everything else that I experience day to day, and then I'll come back and see what has come of it. So I kind of write poems in my head. And keep them there until I feel comfortable putting them down, I suppose, yeah.
Please share another piece of your work.
Let's see. This next one I wrote last summer, and I was watching the cat in my apartment, and she likes to look at the birds outside the windows and, like, imagine that she's, you know, in my head, I think she's trying to, like, wanting to chase them, obviously, and hopefully kill them and eat them. So I think it's kind of funny that this, in my eyes, this sweet creature is trying to get out there and kill this bird. So the poem is called Watching the Cat Hunt. The cat sits patiently on the corner of the table as the leaves outside tempt with birds. In the light behind the tree, I lean out of the window, tasting the lingering fibers of the day. I could crack them and grind them and spit them onto the heads below, like a mother to her chicks the cat fantasizes about. It is Easter today. End poem.
Very powerful. The images.
Oh,
let's take a brief break. And we'll be right back. Anthony Ingram. I'm here with James Steck. James, I got a question for you.
Okay, great.
All right. All great writers have great writing influences. Who are some of yours, and what makes them great in your eyes?
There's a lot. I think the first poet I was really kind of drawn to, hundreds of years old, but is John Donne. And I am really attracted to his imagery in all of his poems. I felt like he was kind of a maverick in terms of using contradictory images. I mean, I know it's somewhat of a overused poem maybe now or known, it's The Flea. And he's talking about how could you make an animal like a flea, which is usually, you know, seen as something kind of dirty, this medium for love and compassion and the intertwining of blood in this animal between two lovers becomes something really powerful. So I thought it was a lot of his poetry kind of paved the way for really kind of unique and these contradictory images that I find so kind of satisfying and appealing in a way. I'm really also drawn to Gertrude Stein. I learned about her in a class in college, modern poetry. And even my professor was a little unsure of exactly how to analyze Gertrude Stein because she has such a bizarre kind of syntactical and imagistic kind of framing in a poetry. It's very hard to kind of distill a tangible meaning sometimes. But I kind of see it as a way of her breaking down order and then rearranging order of either an image she's looking at or even an idea. And so I find that really fascinating. More kind of contemporary writers. I was introduced to Charles Bukowski a few years ago. And I think when reading him, I think everybody should maybe take it with a grain of salt sometimes. But I think there's a sensitivity to observation and understanding in a way in his work and rawness and that I really enjoy. And I don't know if you know José Olivares. I was introduced to actually last year. My mentor teacher gave me a book of poetry of his, and it's called Citizen Illegal. But the poetry throughout I found so visceral and alluring and appealing and also very confessional, which I really enjoyed. And then finally, I've been reading a lot of David Foster Wallace's essays. And I feel like his kind of analysis on consumerism and, again, social contradictions and hypocrisies, I find also very appealing, and I think I am influenced by a lot of his kind of thinking and writings. So there's just a few of the writers that I think about often when I'm trying to produce my own work.
Please share another piece of your work.
The next one's called Atlantic Spider. The web arranges itself when we all look, or the wanderer is caught unnoticed in the space between the architecture of the cedar dune fencing. Its abdomen expels thread after thread, crafting only for the wind and the sand on the backs of the sunbathers, more distinct each moment as the web catches nothing and leaves us. End poem.
You stated that you write a lot when you can.
Yeah.
What are some of the most prevalent ingredients that go into the concoction we call a poem?
Prevalent ingredients. What an interesting question. I suppose observation, at least for me, is one of the biggest ingredients, or sensitive observation, close observation. And I think I learned how to do that through art, and blind contour drawing, where we would have to practice drawing an image with as much detail as possible without ever looking at this, at our paper that we were drawing on. And I feel like that process kind of trained me in a way to become a very sensitive observer. So observation, I think, is a big ingredient. Emotion, I think, also has to be an ingredient. And maybe compassionate emotion. I try to kind of concentrate emotion, or squeeze it down into something that is, that avoids abstraction in a way, because I want the poem to be tangible. I don't want it to be kind of lost in abstraction.
All right.
So I try to distill emotion and observation down into something concrete and tangible, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does.
And I think when I can, I try to incorporate some sort of humor, some sort of everyday kind of instance of something humorous in a way, because if I do that enough, if I distill emotion down enough, if I distill observation down into something so concentrated, I feel like sometimes then I run the risk of running into something maybe didactic, I want to avoid a poem that is like something like a lecture, you know, because that's not why poetry exists. Not sure if I'm answering that question correctly. Or
no, that was a great answer. Great answer. Please share another piece of your work.
I'll do a kind of a funny one, I guess, then.
All right.
Talking about humor. This one was recently published in Goat's Milk magazine. And it's called My Squatty Got a Biscotti. In the morning, her mouth guard is still inside, protecting the teeth, forcing an infantilized lisp. I give her a kiss and tell her, I love you. She smiles unawake and slowly replies, I had a dream of a poem called My Squatty Got a Biscotti. It was about you, me, Ron, a mystery man, and Hermione. I then had to go teach much less satisfying stories that morning. End poem.
Please share another, please.
This other one is also from Goat's Milk magazine, issue 4. It's called Allegory of the Magazine. A cloud consists of molecules and atoms and subatomic particles, the same as magazines and waiting rooms, piled upon one another like sandwich meat. Celebrity sex, celebrity tips, celebrity sex tips, and what they don't tell you about eating sandwich meat, molecules. I think I've already inhaled all the death when I was born, walking on concrete streets, washing toilets, and forcing sleep. The sun scorches clouds and like a blanket against backs. Light. Blind. The warmth may as well be me. And then the absence of it all. Cold. Beyond our reach. So we illustrate ourselves. End poem.
What style of poetry do you prefer? Freestyle, rhyming? What do you prefer?
I find myself writing mostly in free verse. And I think that's mainly because it's the type of poetry that generationally that I was introduced
Okay.
to most early. But I also really try and pay attention to the beat and the rhythm of the words that are in each line. And I also really enjoy internal rhymes and kind of subtle rhymes within the poetry to kind of push the narrative along in some sort of way. But I love reading all types of poetry. I'm not limited. I try not to limit myself, at least, to just free verse or freestyle poetry. But I think free verse poetry kind of forces me sometimes to really pay attention to the potency of each line. And I guess I've never really liked rules in terms of like writing or creative work. And so I'm naturally drawn to break rules and not pay attention to rules, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mostly write in free verse.
All right. Tell us about your process. Is it pen to paper, computer, notebooks? How do you write?
I write on everything. If there's a piece of paper in front of me, and there's a pen around or a pencil, then either there's going to be some sort of weird doodle drawing of some grotesque looking cartoon face or some kind of thought or idea jotted down. And I usually try to stay in a notebook or stay on paper to start with. I think that slows me down, which I think is a good thing. It kind of holds me back to avoid overwriting sometimes. I feel like when I write on my computer, I'll overwrite. What I mean by that, I'll put like too much down that it becomes abstract. It becomes something of, I kind of lose myself in the writing. And so I'm not able to bend to the will anymore because it's become all about me and what I wanted to put down. So I like writing in a journal, writing on paper, scribbling down notes sometimes while I'm teaching. If there's a break in the lesson, I'll scribble down something that I just thought of and come back to it later, either on a piece of paper or a post-it note. So yeah, anywhere and everywhere, on my phone, in my phone notes, anywhere that is available.
You know, since you've been published, does knowing that your poems are published and out in the world validate you being a
yeah.
poet, or are you content knowing that they're out of your system?
I don't think being published is like a point of validation. I like that other people connect to something I'm saying. Because as a teacher, I always try to connect to people, have them try to understand something that I think is important. And maybe there's like a sense of that is like selfish, but if I can connect to someone, if I can help someone feel something or see something in a nuanced way, then I feel like that's all a poet is. And to be able to connect to people on a deep and emotional level. And so publishing, I don't think has anything really to do with it, except for being able to connect to people and trying to share a construction of the world, a reflection of the world in a way, I think, yeah.
Do you think that you were meant to be a poet?
I don't know if anybody was meant to be anything.
Okay.
When it comes down to it. but I guess it's something that I can't avoid. I can't not write. If I like, I suppose it feels like I would explode if I couldn't put words down. They have to come out. It's almost like a release when they do come out. And it's almost as if I'm hitting an equilibrium when words do come out onto paper. It's truly, it's something that I just can't avoid. So I guess in that sense, maybe yes, but I don't know where to go with that, I suppose.
Right.
But it's definitely something that I can't avoid. Yeah.
Mm. I like that you can't avoid poetry. That you can't avoid vomiting on the page, as you stated earlier.
I can't avoid vomiting on the page.
And that's important to know. I mean, that level of self-awareness that you need to do it. And it's such a positive thing to do that I understand that.
Yeah.
I understand. You know, you teach. You're in the trenches. And you may have already answered this question. What do you see as the role of a poet in modern-day society?
Oh, boy. Let me think about that one. Poet in modern-day society. I guess, to me, as an act of record-keeping, and... but not just kind of here are the facts, here's what happened, but more so what was the cultural or emotional significance behind what's going on at any given point in time. And kind of further than that, just one specific person or one specific moment at this point in time. And so in that way, it's a sense of record keeping for humanity, humanity's emotions and what our fears were, what our anxieties were, what our hopes were and dreams, trying to capture what will always be disappearing, I suppose. So I think today and always, I think a poet has always been some sort of record keeper. Of feeling and how feelings kind of swell and contract through time and shift. Maybe that was, I don't know, it's all BS, but maybe not. I don't know. Poetry is a funky thing.
No, I think you're right. We do operate as record keepers. We do operate as record keepers. I like that very much. Now, you've used the word emotion quite a bit.
Mm.
Do you think that someone could be a poet if they don't strongly feel emotions?
No, I mean, you gotta feel things. and I think you have to feel things acutely. And be willing to be uncomfortable maybe with what you feel and accept that, I suppose. So, yeah, I don't know how a thing, I don't know how a piece of poetry could be written without emotion. I don't know what that would look like, a bunch of binary code, certain ones.
Well, with that in mind, share another piece of your work.
Let's see. This poem is called August in D.C., and it was published in the Rye Whiskey Review. Flowers in the summer smell like gasoline over the roofs. The amber night stained by cigarette smoke holds us inside botanical gardens. Butterflies watch beasts take photos and delete the butterflies. The damp trash smells sweet in the summer, and the sky is milky gray, romantic, to heartbeat heretics at least, filtered water. The hyacinth girl hides behind a phone. I don't care much to see her face anyway. We are dying younger each day. We are dying younger each day.
Please share another.
Okay. So I've got a poem here that I wrote recently. And it's called The Keeper of Memories. Over the month of December, I was home up in upstate New York. And my dad, he's a big keeper, I suppose, of memories. And so there's photographs all over the house. There's photographs of myself, my sister, we were younger. And he has always documented our lives. And recently in December, he found this old Super 8 where he didn't know if it was going to work or not, and the film still worked somehow. And I saw all these images played before me, and it was absolutely beautiful. So that's kind of the context behind, or the feeling behind this poem. The Keeper of Memories sits as the ocean passes away, scraping to stay with each receding swell. We sit in Albany, New York, watching old film from a Super 8 flicker against a whiteboard as glimpses of faces and smiles and silent conversations and forgotten languages drift, scarred and tattooed from the time travel endured. The keeper's hands are large, dry and coarse from trying to steer a vanishing wheel, projecting, never turning the lens toward himself, always holding onto time, trying to slow it down with his hands burning like a titan, never slack. Those hands that guide that brittle film, those hands that scrape skin and scratch cotton, for the passage of time he holds still, as he holds those to the skin of his chest or the stubble of his cheek, as if placed on sand to let the ocean rub your body raw, to the bones, to the marrow, to have the water hold you as you vanish. End poem.
That was beautiful. That was beautiful. You know, they say that to see the world with complete honesty, one should look to comedians, artists, and poets. What do you think emerges naturally from your work? As you think about who you are, what emerges from you?
Oh, man. What emerges from me in my work, or through my work? Boy, that is a hard question.
Well, think about who you are.
Like I'm so...
Think about you,
yeah.
Your life, the things you've written about. What would I learn from you? What emerges from you that I would see, that I would understand?
I suppose you might see my past in terms of how I felt like maybe I was raised, what sorts of points throughout time maybe make me uncomfortable, or what moments presently I view as maybe hypocritical or something that needs to be paid attention to. And through what is paid attention, I suppose you would grow an understanding of who I am and why I pay attention to certain things. For example, I'm trying to think of another poem here. It's called December Morning, and maybe this will kind of help me collect my thoughts,
right,
in terms of what is emerging, what I pay attention to. Rain, as gray as your skin, defines the softer parts of hands that scrape along brick buildings like tearing paper. The raincoats suction to bodies, hoods collect faces, hands are pocketed as huddled tents greet you from the mouth of the E Street tunnel and introduce you to the gentle snowfall. The benches forage for faces, waiting for the tossing of eyes to break through the rain snow, to consider resting, to rock backwards into the groan of cracked wood metal, to feel a gripping hand with soil-stained fingers catch your falling body upon splintered arms. You take your own notes on time. End poem. So there's, I drive past or through the E Street tunnel on my way to work every morning. Mm-hmm. And I count and I keep track of how many new tents are put up just outside the tunnel. And so.
Homeless tents?
Yeah.
All right.
And I pay attention to how many keep showing up over the course of months, weeks. And I suppose what I pay attention to is, in a way, like painful or uncomfortable. And so maybe that is kind of what emerges through my poetry sometimes, or often, I suppose. I don't know if any of this answered your question initially.
don't worry about whether you answered it or not.
All right.
I just like hearing your thoughts. I like hearing your thoughts.
Okay.
Well, look, let's take a brief break, and we'll be right back.
Yeah.
We are back. I'm Michael Anthony Ingram. I am here with James Steck, and I want to share with you, James, based on what I have witnessed in terms of who you are and your work, you're someone who's still growing. You're still gelling as a creation,
yeah. And
I think that's extremely important. I really, really do, and I hope you just continue your journey in terms of finding out who you are and finding out your place in the world. That's what's critical.
Mm. Yeah, I do. I still feel like I'm trying to find the voice that, or voices that are floating
mm-hmm.
around, crawling, kind of scratching their way out, and what they all mean, I suppose, for me.
Well, share another piece of your work, and we'll continue the process. Share another piece of your work.
So the next poem, I've arranged it in a way that it can be read in four different ways. And so it's four-dimensional, in a sense. There's three columns on the page, and you can read, you know, the first column, the middle column, and the final column on the right-hand side of the page. But you can also zigzag your way down this poem, and it still makes sense. and it's called Fear in Four Dimensions. I'll read the first column here. Condensed air moves slowly. We are always in between and dripping like water. That's the first column. Second column. Pathologically like thoughts, floating in synapses, screens, lying to us as they drift like paint. The city, swinging bodies. I don't want to die. The third column. From neuron to neuron, like shadows beneath tonight's clouds notoriously, cars break atop hot pavement. And then all the columns connected. Condensed air moves slowly, pathologically like thoughts, from neuron to neuron. Floating in synapses, we are always in between screens, like shadows beneath tonight's clouds, notoriously lying to us as they drift like paint and dripping. The city cars break atop hot pavement, swinging bodies like water. I don't want to die. I don't want to die. End poem.
I like that. Why did you decide to craft it in that way?
I like puzzles. I like word puzzles. And I like challenging myself in terms of how many ways, how many meanings can I get out of this one piece of writing? And it also felt like kind of this another process of bending to the shape of the poem or bending the will of the poem. And it felt like, for me, that this shape, the structure, was the most kind of succinct way of displaying kind of the integrity of this poem.
You know, all poets have several words that come up over and over again, words or sentences that they just can't help but use in their work. What are three of your absolute favorite words to use?
Favorite words? Boy, that's, I never think about them as favorite words, but there's definitely words that keep popping up. I think time, the word time, is definitely repeated often. I think movement. Movement in terms of something's always moving in a direction in the poems, like literally moving in a direction. I think soft, the word soft pops up.
All right.
Over and over again, hands, fingers, I'm seeing is kind of running through these poems. Yeah, definitely hands, a lot of hands. And pupils, eyes.
And pupils?
Yeah, like the pupil of your eye.
Okay. Why does that, tell me about that one. Why does that pop up so much?
The word pupil?
Yes.
Oh. I suppose because I am so observant, and observation for me comes so visually, and the immediate reaction of what I'm looking at is, I guess, immediately coming through my pupils, but it's also a way to, I'm losing myself totally.
That's okay. That's okay. There are no rights or wrongs. There are no rights or wrongs.
Yeah, I guess it always has to do with trying to find, for me, like, who's looking and why are they looking and what they're looking at.
Okay.
I like to walk down the street a lot, and I like to look, you know, where people's eyes go and where their eyes are tracking. So I find that very fascinating to see what this person is looking at. And I try to kind of think, why are they looking at this? I wonder what's going on behind those eyes. And I think that's why it keeps popping up. Maybe I think I'm always trying to search for another person to maybe look up and make eye contact. In a way, yeah.
Well, has your idea of poetry changed since you began writing poems? What it is and what it can do.
My idea of poetry changed. I think it has. I think it started out as a means to kind of process emotions, process what I'm seeing. And that's still definitely a part of it, but it got to the point, especially in college, where I create these massive poems that kind of lost themselves in kind of metaphysical abstraction. And it was too subjective almost. And I remember workshopping these poems in college, and people were having trouble connecting to them, or getting lost, muddled, kind of what was trying to be said here. And so in terms of trying to, as I said earlier, concentrate and distill what I'm looking at, and trying to keep the integrity of the emotion behind it, though, but always trying to keep it concrete, something to hold on to as I jump into something.
Mm-hmm. Share another piece of your work.
This poem's called The Guitarist. And this was also published in the Rye Whiskey Review. The guitarist alone drifts up and out from his effort burning, fingers strumming into the blur. Humidity rests on shoulders like the children above the crowd, gripping their parents' hair in little fists, curling the song up wordless like ocean water, forcing its body around theirs, sunlight into aching pupils. The air contributes only to the movement of the sound between the strings. As a young girl howls, she feels it, turns to her mom and points. She is the only one who notices through the decaying night and the saturation, that dead light in the sky. End poem.
Wow, I can see that. I can really see that. That was incredible, James.
Thank you.
Very powerful piece. You know, some poets also find themselves active in other creative activities. What are some of your favorite non-poetry or literature activities?
I love to sketch and draw. I like to cartoon a lot, so I kind of draw caricatures of people.
Okay.
And I pay a lot of attention to, I guess, the human body. And so I sketch either people walking down the street or somebody sitting in a chair in an airport. I try to capture kind of the feeling of this person walking or sitting or doing something, eating, anything. But I really love drawing. I love capturing an image. I love capturing the kind of movement of a body in space. And so drawing is kind of another obsession of mine as a creative outlet. Other than that, I love music. I love listening to music. I don't make any music, but I sing a lot.
Okay.
But, not anything special. Just I do enjoy singing, though. Yeah. But those are some outlets, other outlets that I find myself kind of diving into, for sure.
Do you also write about these outlets in your poetry?
Yeah. So the sketch about the man sitting in an airport there's a poem that goes along with it, and both the poem and the drawing were published by the Wild Word magazine. It's based in Germany. And this poem is called Sketch of a Man in the Air. He sits with his legs crossed, now apart. The weight of his head is in his hands. They cup his chin. Frameless glasses hover over a prominent nose. His hair thins, pale, like the gold band on his finger. Fingernails, well cut. Lips, thin. Ears, small. His thin chest is opened by a faded blue polo. I've forgotten to finish my coffee. It's lukewarm, like hazel eyes. End poem.
You know, you've probably already answered this question, but I just wanted to, I guess, to hear it again, hear your answer again. what do you want your poetry to do? Where do you want it to go?
I want my poetry, I suppose, to ultimately just connect with people, with anybody. If somebody has made a connection, has felt understood, or felt like something rang true for them, even if it's just one line in a poem, then I think that's ultimately what I want, to try and connect people with each other, with art, with emotion, with sensitivity and observation. And yeah, when it comes down to it, it is really just about connection. And seeing,
right.
Really seeing people. And I think that's the best answer I can provide for right now.
All right. Where do you want it to go?
Where do I want it to go? Wow. I guess, are you asking kind of like if what I'm trying to physically make out of all these poems, or what I want to do with the poetry, I guess.
What do you want to do with the poetry?
Well, tangibly, I would like to put together a book. I've got over 100 poems right now, just
oh, wow.
Kind of sitting in an unending document on Google Docs that I keep going back to. Trying to edit and refine and concentrate and distill, but I would love to publish a collection, or if not a collection, at least a chapbook, something short that's thematically focused, because I feel like a lot of my poems have to do with kind of urban settings and contradictions and anxieties, and I feel like that would kind of tie in nicely to a nice thematic concept. So I guess that's physically what I want to do in the near future, is to either hopefully publish a book soon or a chapbook. And then what I want to do also with my poetry is hopefully use it as a means to, not my own poetry, but poetry in general, to connect with my students and to have them see value in distilling emotion, figuring out how to connect with people. And then I suppose I'm trying to find ways to push myself and to be challenged. I always want to be better. I want to be a better writer. I want to be able to put together a better poem, always. So I'm trying to find outlets or resources or ways to do that, whether it's applying to writing residencies and just trying to meet new people and trying to workshop with whoever's writing, whoever's wanting to read some poems and give me their thoughts. Yeah.
You know, we've reached the end of the hour.
Oh, wow.
Can you believe it?
Yeah. I went by so fast, honestly. I feel like so much more to be said. I don't know.
I hope you don't feel like it was a test.
No, a test. I know at times I'm like, you know, feeling like I'm in my capstone poetry class again, trying to, you know.
Well, you made an A.
I know how much.
You made an A. If you want to know, you made an A. I'd like to thank you so much for being a guest on my show.
For having me here. I mean, it's been a blast, honestly. It was a great conversation, and I loved being here and talking with you.
Well, I see you as being, again, gelling as a creation, coming into your own. And that's so powerful because we don't often get an opportunity to think about our own creation, if that makes sense. Maybe it doesn't. I don't know. But just keep doing, keep doing what you're doing.
Maybe nothing makes sense we're talking about.
That's true. We're both waiting for Godot.
Yeah.
Samuel Beckett is somewhere in watching us both.
Well, thank you so much for a great conversation again.
All right. Well, good night to you and good night to our listening audience.
Yes, thank you.
All right.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you.